I want to wish everyone a good afternoon to those who are here today, both members and guests, and to those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 473rd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, and it comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine. And I'm George Look. For the last 40-plus years, forum members and their guests have been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue related to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website, midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the websites of Maine Public Radio and of the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a forum member. Our membership form is on the forum's website. Our speaker today is Dr. John Lee, who will be speaking on Should America Be Worried About China? John Lee is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He is also a non-resident senior fellow at the United States Studies Center and an adjunct professor at the University of Sydney. From 2016 to 2018, he was senior national security advisor to the Australian Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop. In this role, he served as a principal advisor on Asia and for economic, strategic, and political affairs in the Indo-Pacific region. Dr. Lee was also appointed the Foreign Minister's lead advisor on the 2017 Foreign Policy White Paper, the first comprehensive foreign affairs blueprint for Australia since 2003, and written to guide Australia's external engagement for the next 10 years and beyond. He also has held an adjunct professorship at the Australian National University. He's one of the foremost experts on the Chinese political economy and on strategic and economic affairs pertaining to the Indo-Pacific. Dr. Lee's articles have been published in leading policy and academic journals in the United States, Asia, and Australia. He received his master's and doctorate in international relations from the University of Oxford and his Bachelor of Laws and Arts degree from the University of New South Wales. He is based in Sydney, Australia, and we are pleased that he's traveled from there to here today to be with us. John, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Well, thank you, George, for that wonderful introduction. I want to thank Eric and Diane for getting me out of Australia, but not just out of Australia, but to Maine, not just New York or DC or LA, but to Maine, which is the first time I've been here, and by far the most beautiful place in America I've been to. I mean that sincerely. And finally, it's one thing to visit a place, but to actually speak to people who live in a place, which the Midcoast Forum has allowed me to do, is something else. So I feel very privileged, and I thank you all for giving up your afternoon to listen to me. Now, in 12 of the past 16 cases where a rising superpower has threatened to displace an existing superpower, it has led to a war. China is a rising superpower. America is the pre-existing superpower. So from a historical point of view, the odds are not looking that great in favor of peace. Now, are we destined to repeat history? And can we avoid bloodshed in our time? To help answer that question, let me consider what China wants. I have studied the Chinese Communist Party for the past 15 years. I've watched the evolution of Chinese domestic and foreign policy over that time. And I know what it's like to deal with Beijing from a position inside government and from a position where one is not an American, but a smaller power inside that government. So this is my summary of what China wants. The Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP, which has been in power since the foundation of modern China in 1949, it has three core objectives. The first one, which wouldn't surprise you, is to remain in power. The second one is to ease the United States out of Asia in military terms, in economic, in institutional, and even in normative terms. And a third objective is to spread its military, economic, and institutional interests and values throughout the region. Now, objectives are easy to identify in a sense, but the question now is, what is China's strategy or grand strategy to achieve these three objectives? I'll tell you three or four. The first one is for China to simplify and reduce the complexity of the strategic map around itself. And what I mean by this is that for China, the fewer active strategic players there are in a region, the better. The Chinese ideal is that other regional states like Australia remain on the sidelines or remain neutral. And as a distant power in Asia, you guys, the United States, you need the full cooperation of allies to remain forward-leaning and positioned in my part of the world. So if countries like Australia and Japan are unwilling or unable to enable the American presence, China wins without a shot being fired because America cannot sustain its presence in my part of the world. The second element of China's strategy is for China to gradually achieve a state of affairs in a region which is in its interest. So this means the integration of Taiwan, the dominance of the South China Sea, to weaken Japan, to dominate supply chains, and to ensure that neighbouring states are as dependent on China for finance and technology, for access to markets, and for economic inputs. So what this means is China wants to gradually achieve this dominance without provoking a war with the United States. The third element of the Chinese strategy is that in every context, whether it be military, diplomatic, or economic, China has to ensure that its willingness to escalate and its capacity to escalate is more credible than either that of the United States or any other state in the region. And if you think about it this way, if you believe that China is prepared to escalate beyond what you are prepared to do, you essentially lose your resolve, you lose your strategic creativity, and you lose your courage. So that is what China is trying to achieve. The fourth thing China wants to do, it needs to entrench and normalize aspects of Chinese behavior, especially coercion and the arbitrary giving of benefits and largesse to other countries. So China, in a sense, wants a different standard for itself. It wants other countries to accept that its methods are coercive, and that is just the way it is, and there's nothing you can do about it. And of course, if you internalize this kind of expectation of China, by definition, it means you accept it, and China is able to entrench that pattern of behavior in the region. Now, in the Chinese conception of the regional order, the Asian order, and beyond, but mainly in Asia, its conception is that the order has to be hierarchical. Its leaders are very clear about this. This is not me imputing or even inferring a conception of what they want. Its leaders are very open about the way a Chinese-led order should be. So you had an example where its foreign minister a few years ago met with his Southeast Asian counterparts in Singapore, and he said to them directly, there are big powers, there are small powers, that is just a fact. Now, China must be on top, and it has to have special rights and privileges. Now, all other states beneath in this hierarchy, They will compete or undermine each other to gain a higher status within the Chinese-led hierarchy, but China has to always be on top. So this is the Chinese Communist Party's conception of what the various imperial dynasties were like over the past 4,000 years. And this is something which current Chinese leaders reach back into and talk about, that they want to build a modern-day structure resembling the imperial dynasties that China in its various forms had hundreds and thousands of years ago. So this was a period where China, referring to itself as the Middle Kingdom, literally the middle entity in all of Asia, the Middle Kingdom was the entity to which all other entities, whether they be states or something else, paid tribute. They were obedient. They relied on Chinese largesse and generosity. And China was both feared and respected by all. So this is what Xi Jinping, the current leader, means when he talks about the rejuvenation of China, what he calls the China Dream. This is the most important and consistent vision he has for his country. So in this sense, China sees itself as the greatest imperial civilization, and I use that word deliberately because they use it, civilization, existing in a modern and unnatural world of sovereign equal states, which they see as a relatively recent construction and imposition on the Asian order. So to give you one illustration of how this Chinese order might look like, a real-life illustration, Australia, as you might know, endured 3 years of fairly severe economic sanctions against us. Now, of course, we took policies that the Chinese didn't like, but let's look at what policies it was that we took that the Chinese didn't like. And luckily for us, they told us. In November 2021, a senior official from the Chinese embassy met an Australian journalist from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and handed him a slip of paper with 14 grievances. That's actually what it was entitled. 14 grievances which came directly from the leadership in Beijing. And these 14 grievances were explanations to us as to why we're being punished and what we had to do to wind back these punishments. Now, according to the document, the 14 grievances, if you look at the 14 grievances, five of these complaints or grievances had to do with Australia's external policy. So these included criticism of human rights, human rights abuses in Xinjiang, criticisms of Chinese violation of treaty promises over Hong Kong, criticism of the coercion of Taiwan, criticism of Australia's illegal island building in the South China Sea where they've militarized these islands, and Australia working with allies, predominantly the United States, to forward defense policies that the Chinese did not like. Now, they consisted of five of the grievances, but the other nine grievances the Chinese had about us related to Australia's domestic policy. So it didn't like Australian authorities blocking Chinese investment in Australia in key sectors. It didn't like us legislating against Chinese foreign interference in our elections and institutions. It didn't like the fact that the government, to use the word, tolerated independent media criticism of China or the Chinese Communist Party. It didn't like the fact that the government funded think tanks that produced reports that were that were critical of China. And it didn't like our domestic security agencies moving against and calling out China's cyber intrusions into not just our government service, but our private sector and personal service. So the point I'm trying to make is Australia could have been a neutral country, But that wasn't enough. China demanded essentially a veto and a direct say over our key domestic decisions made by another country. So this is how a Chinese hierarchical system would work. And if you look around my region, there have been countries that have been suppressed and submitted to this kind of system. You look at countries such as Laos and Cambodia, this is actually how they operate. They give the Chinese a veto over not just their foreign, but their domestic policies. Now, since the end of World War I, the United States, as you know, has been the most advanced, militarily dominant and wealthiest country and economy in the world. America has been able to project power anywhere in the world. Since the end of World War II, few countries have been able to succeed economically without American assistance and access to American markets. So you think about Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Europe, and in the 2000s, even China. At the height of the Cold War, America's economy was 3 times larger than that of the Soviet Union. The Chinese economy is now about 2/3 the size of the American economy. In this sense, China is an unprecedented competitor and rival to the United States. Now, is there hope that the United States can maintain its advantage and prevail? Now, you'll hear a lot of remarkable and daunting statistics that seem to be in China's favour. So let me just throw a couple of random ones at you to make that point. China's share of global manufacturing is almost twice that of America's and 4 times that of Japan. China produces more steel than the next 10 countries combined. There are more patents approved in China each year than in the United States and Japan combined. China already has the largest navy in the world, and the qualitative gap with the United States is narrowing. When you gather these type of macro statistics together, you can come up with some grand narratives that the Chinese leaders promote relentlessly in the region. And these are specific messages that is part of a very concerted, determined Chinese propaganda initiative. And they use that word propaganda in the true sense of the word. So these are the narratives. China might not be democratic in a Western sense, but their system is superior, nevertheless. Chinese dominance of Asia and the Indo-Pacific is inevitable. The Communist Party's strategic objectives, as I've outlined, are permanent and they are unchanging, which means you cannot change the minds of the Chinese Communist Party. And this leads to the fourth one. The Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army are fundamentally undeterrable, and they will pay any price to achieve the objectives. And in by way of contrast, this is the fifth narrative. The United States is unreliable, it's chaotic, and it's a declining superpower. So these are the messages that Beijing very deliberately and systematically spreads into the region with great effect. And if you think about it, they do this because if a country like Australia concludes that America will soon be incapable of providing an effective balance against China, our attitude would be resistance is futile and we might as well strike a bargain with the Chinese before it's too late. The imbalance in Asia allows this kind of mindset to take root, because even if you look at things in military terms, China spends more on its military each year than the combined military budgets of the whole of Asia, South Asia, and the Pacific. So that's why the United States is such a crucial player, and that's why China focuses so much on the United States as part of its grand strategy in terms of easing America out of Asia. Now, there's a former Australian Prime Minister, Paul Keating, who is extremely critical of the Australian alliance with America because he believes China is the inevitable master of Asia and we should just submit and negotiate as beneficial an arrangement with China now before any leverage that we have dissipates. About a year ago, I was in a town hall debate with an Australian billionaire who argued the same thing, that China was the better long-term bet for Australia. I won't talk through the debate, but I will tell you my concluding point to him, which was, if you look at the superannuation or retirement funds of many rich and prominent Australians, including this particular individual, and I've done my research, you will find that their personal retirement funds are all held in American dollar assets. They are not held in Chinese RMB denominated assets. So in my mind, those who are placing a long-term bet on America, I think they are prudent to do so. Despite all the predictions about Chinese dominance and American decline, I argue that agency is with the US. Now, I don't argue in anything that's inevitable about the US, but I argue that agency is with the United States. It, more than any other power in the world, still has the ability to shape Chinese actions for the better, even if we can't change the way that Xi Jinping or the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party thinks about the world. So this brings me to the issue of American and allied agency and leverage over China. And I think we have a lot more than is commonly realised. Take China's strength, which is the perceived size of the Chinese economy. Now, gross domestic product, GDP, is a measurement of economic activity regardless of whether it is economically rational or not. In China, GDP growth is largely driven, predominantly driven by fixed capital investment, that is building lots of stuff everywhere, infrastructure, residential housing, and so on. Now, until recently, the largest Chinese property developer and investor was a company called Evergrande. Evergrande was China's largest property developer, and its approach was not to increase profitability, but scale, to crowd out competitors. So by 2020, Evergrande had 822 pieces of undeveloped land in 222 cities with a planned floor area of 3.3 billion square feet of new homes. That's equivalent to about 10% of Germany's entire housing stock. The Evergrande model was basically this: high debt, high leverage, high turnover, and low cost. Although Evergrande's market share of the national housing development market was only 4%, its liabilities amounted to 3% of China's entire GDP. So the problem for Evergrande, for the Chinese residential housing market, and Evergrande is, I think, an appropriate metaphor for how the Chinese political economy operates, is that fixed investment has much less to do with meeting demand and market signals and much more to do with a desire to achieve scale to crowd out competitors. And by the way, that's what China does as well with its trade and export policies. So for example, urbanization in China has been growing at a rate of about 1 to 1.5% each year since 1995. In that same period, growth in housing stock has increased by around 15% each year over the same period. Now, real estate currently amounts to about 30% of the Chinese GDP. However, around 20% of urban houses, that's one in every five urban houses, is vacant. That's about 70 million empty properties in Chinese cities, which, by the way, could house Chinese moving from rural to urban areas for about the next 20 years without building a single new urban dwelling. Now, I mentioned that Evergrande and the Chinese residential housing market is representative of China's high debt, high leverage, high turnover, and low-cost approach. Now, implications for this, for Chinese power, are enormous. To achieve its geostrategic objectives that I've outlined, China needs to find ways to drive the next phase of growth beyond building more and more things which its domestic economy doesn't need. In its economic forward strategy is therefore based on these two approaches. One, it wants to create guaranteed external markets for its fixed investment firms to replicate this high debt, high leverage, high turnover, low cost model. That is, it needs guaranteed external markets within which Chinese firms continue to build things that other economies don't really need. It also needs to upgrade its economy. And if you look at basic economics, economies grow in one of three ways. You can add more capital, you can add more labour, or you can use these inputs, labour and capital, more efficiently. This is what economists call total factor productivity. Total factor productivity has been declining significantly since around 2008, when China began this fixed investment splurge. China knows that it cannot surpass the United States in an economically meaningful way unless it massively increases total factor productivity, because it's running out of capital and labour inputs to just ram into the economy. So these are what grand plans, which you might have heard of, Belt and Road Initiative, Made in China 2025, the dual circulation policy. These are what these initiatives are all about. It's about creating guaranteed fixed investment markets, positioning China in a position of unrivaled technological strength to dominate supply chains and high-value export markets. And it hopes that it can boost domestic consumption, which will come from higher wages and higher household incomes as China upgrades its entire economy. Now, these plans we need to take seriously, but they speak as much to Chinese fragility as they do Chinese strength. China holds a weaker hand than it lets on. Structural weaknesses stemming from the Chinese Communist Party's iron grip over running its economy are severe and they're worsening. Now, this brings me to the point about American and allied leverage and agency. We can frustrate key parts of the Chinese plan if we're smart and determined enough to do it. So you take China's Belt and Road Initiative, which covers Eurasia and the Western Pacific, but significantly excludes America. Three quarters of the countries in the Belt and Road Initiative have sovereign debt levels rated as junk status by the three major rating companies, or have no rating at all. These are struggling economies, mainly landlocked economies, ruled by poor governments with poor institutions. These are not economies America and allies need to pour money into because they won't get much in return strategically or economically. Instead, we just need to compete in the maritime economies of Indo-Pacific, where the balance of regional power will be determined. For example, it's not well known that Japan, not China, is the major source of foreign direct investment in Southeast Asia. We need to go with our private sector strengths. We need to outcompete China in these more important markets, and we need to drive Chinese capital to these less efficient markets to make it more expensive and also strategically ineffective for the Belt and Road Initiative. So you consider what China needs to upscale its economy. It needs investment at scale. It needs access to large and advanced markets. It needs a world-class system to produce innovation, and it needs channel to acquire technology and know-how. It's not well known, once again, that China is actually a net importer of relevant technologies and know-how and relies heavily on joint ventures with foreign firms in many of these sectors inside China to acquire these technologies and innovations. If you just look in the last decade alone, about 80% of private R&D money, research and development money spent in China was by non-Chinese multinationals, mainly headquartered in America. This gives you an idea of American leverage over the Chinese upscaling ambition. We can scrutinize and restrict capital into China selectively, particularly in sectors that feed directly into its strategic plans designed to surpass the United States. We can restrict or ban categories of investment into China or Chinese investment into America, such as in computer design, in biotech, AI, and life sciences. Broadly speaking, China needs the advanced democracies to give it the capital, technologies, know-how, and market access it needs to achieve its economic and strategic objectives. In other words, we actually have to leverage if we want to use it. Now, by way of some concluding remarks, I'm not at all suggesting China is a paper tiger. It will become more and more of a formidable threat if we remain passive and inactive. It was really until the Trump administration, and this has been continued by the Biden administration, that Chinese policies were called out. It was really until the Trump and Biden administrations that China began to experience pushback from the United States as a result of these practices and objectives that I've outlined. Before that, China expected minimal pushback, and I often argue that China has achieved as much as it has because it has not had to factor in any cost or price or risk of pursuing the policies that I mentioned. Now, every leader, regime, or country will make cost-benefit calculations. China, as I argued, has so far suffered relatively small costs for aggression and for illegitimate and unfair economic actions. We have allowed China to think that its current approach will be successful in achieving its objectives. And the worst thing we can do is to believe that our failure is inevitable and China's success is assured. If we do that, then that essentially is directly feeding into the Chinese game plan for how it's trying to prevail in the Asia Pacific. Now, what does the world look like for America and for Australia if we don't take the initiative and place significant restrictions on China? Now, this is not about complete disengagement. This is about strategic restrictions on China. First, America will be unable to project power into the Asia Pacific because you need your allies to host your assets and troops, and they will be unwilling to do so under Chinese coercion and dependency. America will be locked out or severely restricted from freely acting economic terms in Asia, which is the source of much of your prosperity and from where your key supplies are located. The terms of trade, supply, and prices of inputs from Asia will be dictated to you by China. The result is that America will be greatly diminished. It will become, like Britain or France in a post-World War II world, a significant Atlantic power, but no longer a Pacific or global power. Like Britain or France, America will have severe reduced ability to influence the rules of trade, finance, diplomacy, and in global institutions. Since after the First World War, the United States has shaped the world more than any other nation. If China is allowed to execute its grand strategy, this will be the last generation of Americans to enjoy this privilege. Now, finally, you might have heard about the urgency of deterring China from launching military action against Taiwan. So let me just say a few words about this issue. If there is a war against Taiwan, the effects will be global and devastating. The impact on the rest of the world will be incomparable compared to the effects of the current Russian invasion of Ukraine. Most modelling suggests that if there's a war in Taiwan, world GDP will decline by around 10%. If there is a war in the Taiwan Straits, trade to and from the entire Northeast Asia to the rest of the world will be severely restricted because merchant ships will not be able or willing to operate in these waters. So now you essentially isolate Japan and South Korea and, of course, Taiwan from the global economy. That would be an enormous disaster. Taiwan is the producer of 2/3 of the world's semiconductors, and that trade will be devastated. Most electronics and manufactured goods are produced or assembled in Northeast Asia, and a flow of this will be severely restricted. The strategic consequences are just as severe. If America chooses or cannot defend Taiwan, other allies will lose faith in America as the senior alliance partner and will begin to consider other security options. This will be the beginning of the end of the American alliance system in Asia. If Taiwan is taken by China, it allows China and the People's Liberation Army a clear pathway to break out into the Western Pacific. Your territory and base in Guam will be isolated or destroyed. Japan will be surrounded. Southeast Asia will be completely vulnerable to Chinese coercion, and Australia will be isolated. Japan will respond by becoming a nuclear weapons power. South Korea will then do the same. Australia is likely to do so as well. And when Australia does so, Indonesia will consider it. So that's the world we face if we allow the genie out of the bottle. The peaceful and prosperous place that Asia is currently is will be no more, and American prosperity and security will suffer. Xi Jinping has appointed himself president for life. To achieve that, he has put millions of Chinese Communist Party officials in jail. This includes thousands of senior officials at the highest levels. To maintain his standing and legitimacy, he has promised that he will achieve the party's long-time desire to integrate China into the People's Republic, integrate Taiwan into the People's Republic of China, even though Taiwan has never been part of the People's Republic of China. The initial plan was to do so peacefully through providing economic incentives to the Taiwanese. This has not worked. As China has become more authoritarian, the Taiwanese people do not want to be part of China. This means Xi's only option is likely to be force, and he has instructed his military to be ready to launch a successful invasion of Taiwan by 2027. Once again, this is proclaimed very openly. It's through Chinese doctrine, operational doctrine, and instruction. A successful invasion means repelling Taiwanese resistance and landing Chinese troops in Taiwan to hold the territory. China cannot just blow up Taiwan, it needs to take Taiwan largely intact because it wants to integrate Taiwan into the mainland as one of its provinces. At the moment, China has land, sea, and undersea dominance in the Taiwan Straits, but it cannot land troops without incurring huge and prohibitive losses. Xi plans to have this dominant amphibious capability by 2027. This sounds dim, but we can deter and stop such an invasion. First, Taiwan needs to be able to withstand a Chinese barrage for a few weeks. This is the time America and its allies, such as Japan, needs to reorganize its forces and reach the Taiwan Straits. Second, America and others need to be willing and able to absorb any Chinese onslaught. the longer the conflict goes on, the more the military and economic advantage shifts to us, and the more China will struggle, in no small part because China will be increasingly blockaded in such a scenario. Third, we have to convince Xi Jinping that he will be in existential political danger if and when his invasion fails, so he best not try such a maneuver. If Xi Jinping launches an invasion of Taiwan and it isn't successful, it is most likely an existential moment for him. He will probably land himself in jail or worse. So we need to convince Xi Jinping we have the will and the capability to prevent a successful invasion, and that should he try, he is playing with fire when it comes to his own political and personal interests. These are all possible to achieve, but if we fail to do these things, America and Australia will be in a far darker, poorer, and more dangerous world. Thank you. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.
John, I think you've painted a fairly frightening picture here for us.
Optimist.
While we collect questions from people here, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. You've said in your talk that the Chinese take a very long view of the world and the situation. The United States, even in the best of times, I think, is incapable of doing that. Are there certain elements of that you can see are certain actions or policies that the United States could take that could survive the changes in administrations that would put us on a good glide path, or is it all lost?
No, I'm more optimistic than I was five or so years ago. Because
this is your optimism.
Well, the fundamental optimism is that the United States has the agency. You know, we are facing formidable threats and challenges, but the United States has the agency. But to answer your specific question, you know, if you look at the Trump to the Biden administrations, in all fairness to Trump changed the conversation in China. It may have been for the wrong reasons, but he actually called out things the Chinese were doing, and was the first president or administration prepared to impose costs on China. The Obama administration, the Bush administration, Clinton, they were never prepared to actually do that. Now, Trump probably didn't have as much of a strategy behind it. It was more about imposing costs in China to achieve some shorter-term concessions. But nevertheless, he began that conversation, that process. When the Biden administration came in, I know politics in your country these days are very divisive and there's a lot of disagreement, but there really hasn't been a lot of disagreement from Trump to Biden on China policy. That gives me hope, because that tells me that this idea that you need to now not just push back, but shape Chinese actions through cost imposition, if need be, this has become entrenched in your institutions. So now, even when I deal with your State Department, your Defense Department, your National Security Council, many of your experts, the conversation and policies have completely changed. So I, of course, in this upcoming election, you know, there are a lot of domestic issues that you guys are divided about, but certainly from an Australian point of view, we're not overly concerned whether it's a Biden or Trump administration, just because we think this policy will continue. The final thing I would say is that, you know, America often looks weaker than what it is, because obviously you guys tend to voice your disagreements and in public, unlike the Chinese. But if you look at the ingrained power and leverage you guys have, you know, your private sector is rarely seen as an element of statecraft, because private sector people do what they want to do. But nevertheless, as I argued, China needs to achieve what your private sector is achieving, and it can't do that without substantial American assistance and access. that can be easily restricted or blocked. So that's something which the United States can do very well.
Thank you. Number of questions about Taiwan, which you discussed pretty extensively at the end. One interesting one, I think, here is, regarding Taiwan, what lessons, if any, has China taken from Russia's invasion of Ukraine? For example, the ability to evade sanctions, neutrality of nations like India, etc.
China, to their credit, has been a great student of the Russian-Ukraine experience, and it's come to a few conclusions. The first thing is, if you want to invade a country, make sure you have good intelligence and you win quickly. So that has been the number one lesson. By the way, if you remember back to just before the invasion, a few weeks before the invasion, Xi Jinping and Putin met and they emerged and declared they had a no-limits partnership. Now, I would be shocked if Xi Jinping had no knowledge of this impending invasion. The point I'm trying to make is that Xi Jinping wouldn't have done that if he was not confident the Russians were going to win in Ukraine easily. So the fact that Russia has not done that, that's a lesson for the Chinese. If you're going to do it quickly. The second lesson, which stems from the first, is allies and partners won't come to your assistance unless you show you're able to resist and help yourself. So that's why I emphasize Taiwan needs to show that it's prepared for war, that in the case of a war, it can actually resist, and that assistance by outside powers isn't a hopeless cause, because the United States, understandably, is not going to engage in a hopeless cause. The third thing, which relates to something you mentioned, is what China really fears in the event of war are American sanctions, particularly American sanctions on the use of American dollar transactions, because currently China is still dependent on that. So what China has been trying to do, and this is part of its war planning, if you like, is to try to wean itself off dependency on the American dollar. And it's trying to do that by signing bilateral agreements with its trading partners that will bypass the use of the American dollar as a trading currency. It's had some success, but limited success, because for China to succeed in bypassing the American dollar, people need to have the confidence to hold Chinese RMB. And you're not going to have the confidence to hold Chinese RMB if you don't trust the Chinese system, or if it has a closed capital account, which China currently has. So this is another example why I'm actually quite optimistic when it comes to American options. I don't think China has a way of actually bypassing the use of the American dollar. And if it can't do that, it's vulnerable. And the final thing I would say is, remember, China holds trillions of dollars of American debt, right? That actually gives America the leverage, because in the event of war, one of the first things the Department of Treasury here will do is freeze Chinese holdings of American dollar debt. Now, that's not great for the American dollar, but it's even worse for the Chinese, because their whole current account balance depends on this holding of American debt. So that's what I mean. I'm not so pessimistic about the capability and leverage the United States has. The last step of that is to demonstrate you've actually got the willingness to use it, and that's the ultimate deterrent.
And there's a somewhat related question, and it's about, because of China's rising status, does it feel it can subjugate Russia as a sister state?
Well, I'm sure behind closed doors there's a lot of angst between Putin and Xi Jinping, because as the question implies, Russia has become a very junior partner with China. So, for example, when Ukraine war happened, Russia has been forced to sell gas and oil to China at very cheap prices, which is obviously not great for the Russian fiscal position. Russia has had the humiliation, if you like, of being forced to buy munitions from North Korea to sustain the Ukraine war. Now, all through it, I think it's fair to say that if you want to talk about the axis of authoritarian countries, China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran, China has been the big winner out of the Ukraine invasion for two reasons. One, it's now clearly the senior partner in this axis, And two, it has, as it always wants to do, distract the West from Asia towards Europe.
Well, let's switch to the economics for a minute. How does China expect to grow the consumption of its economy when the overall population growth is negative? Can they continue to be the economic miracle they have been?
Well, my assessment is no. I'm quite pessimistic about the Chinese economy for a number of reasons. One, the obvious one, they can't keep on putting capital inputs into things that the country doesn't need. Two, as the question says, you can't keep on putting labour inputs because it's declining demographic. But then, you know, you look at the sort of micro situation as well. You know, this plan to grow exports by creating guaranteed markets for Chinese firms. Chinese exports will grow, but Chinese exports will grow because it has a price advantage, and it has a price advantage because China will suppress the cost of wages and household incomes in the Chinese economy, and that doesn't help consumption. If China really wanted to increase consumption, it would do a couple of things. It would transfer economic opportunity from its state-owned enterprises to the private sector. That would have an enormous, beneficial increase for private income and therefore private consumption. It would institute more social welfare safety nets, which it doesn't really have to any significant degree. This includes pensions. Once again, this would free up the savings of people in the economy. And the last thing it would do is that it would start to make itself a fairer and more welcoming place for foreign companies to operate in, because this would allow the better transfer of know-how and expertise. But the Chinese economy, for strategic and political reasons, is going the other way. So I'm not particularly optimistic that China can get out of this problem that they have.
And here's one on Australia itself. How successful has Australia been in reducing its economic dependence and ties with China? Have you been trying to do that, and how successful has it been?
This is actually a bit of a negative story. We had some success when China imposed the sanctions, because we had no choice. We couldn't sell a lot of our stuff to China. So we feverishly located other markets in India and Southeast Asia and beyond, and we're quite successful in doing so. Even though I broadly support the foreign policy of the current government, when the current government came in, China looking for a way to improve relations with Australia because its coercion hadn't worked, welcomed Australia back. And Australia took the bait, and the government has now instructed its businesses to flood back into China, which is what has happened. So unfortunately, the answer is no. Now, the bit of good news in that is that about two-thirds of our exports to China are commodities, mainly iron ore, mineral commodities. And for at least the next 10 years, China doesn't really have options outside Australia to source good quality, reliable iron ore. So in a sense, we've had a stay of execution, but the strategic rationale, which is a prudent one of diversification away from China, hasn't happened the way I think it should have happened.
I wish we had another hour, because we have at least an hour's more worth of questions here, so I apologize to those who questions didn't ask. But I want to ask one final question, and it's kind of two-part, but how might China misuse its powers should it attain virtual hegemony in the Indo-Pacific region? What is there to be worried about? If we don't think of China as an adversary, are we missing the chance to make China a partner?
The main Chinese threat, first of all, to Australia, and then I'll say to America, to Australia. Let's say China takes Taiwan, it's the People's Liberation Army break out into the Pacific. It's not that Australia thinks China is suddenly going to invade us. It's not. What we're afraid of is that China has greater and greater capacity to force us to take certain policies that we wouldn't otherwise take. So, for example, and I speak from experience, if If we didn't have, if the United States wasn't still a dominant power, if we didn't have relationships with countries like Japan, China could have imposed those conditions that I mentioned onto Australia. Now, Australia would not be a land filled with Chinese troops, but as a country would no longer be the sort of sovereign country we'd like to be. We'd no longer be able to make foreign or even domestic decisions that we would want to make. And for me, that's not the kind of existence for a nation state that I would want to be part of. The problem for the United States is suddenly now the Asia Pacific region, where you have built so much of your wealth and power, you will be locked out from it. Because as I mentioned, the countries around a region will one by one submit to Chinese coercion. Their policies will change. They'll be less welcoming of the American role, the American presence. And you guys are 12,000 miles away. You won't be able to project power and have the kind of role and influence that you have now. And it's not just about American pride or ego. That will have a direct impact on your capacity to influence and have secure supply chains, on being able to operate in fair commodity markets, in being able to strike fair trade deals with, you know, many of your trading partners in my part of the world. If the United States can't do that, then, as I mentioned, become a very diminished power. And I really do mean that you'll become more like France or Britain, a still great power, but no longer a superpower in a way you've been used to.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank
you. It's been very interesting. Thank you. I would have hated to hear your talk during your pessimistic phase.